Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take these huge, complex topics and try to distill them into something clear and, well, genuinely exciting for you.
And today, we are really jumping into the deep end.
We are. We're tackling generative artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
For so many people, I think this whole world just exploded into view in late 2022 with ChatGPT.
Right. And that's the perfect place to start, because you have to frame this correctly. That explosion of public awareness, it wasn't some sudden invention out of nowhere.
Not at all.
No. Our sources are really clear on this. It's the end result of 70 years of slow, systematic work. A long burn that just suddenly caught fire.
I like that, a long burn. So what finally lit the match? The sources point to three big things that all came together, especially since about 2017.
Exactly. You can think of them as three pillars. First, the muscle. Just raw, powerful computing and lots of it.
Specialized chips and all that.
Yep. Second, the fuel. This unimaginable amount of data from the internet. And third, the blueprint. We just got smarter with new AI architectures and new algorithms.
So our mission today is to map that whole journey for you, from the philosophy all the way to the models making art and writing code. Let's start at the very beginning, before computers.
Way before. You have to go back to the 17th century to the philosopher Thomas Hobbes.
Hobbes.
Yeah. He argued that human reasoning is just, well, it's just arithmetic. It's manipulating symbols, and that's the key idea. If reason is just symbol manipulation, maybe a machine can do it.
Okay, so that's the philosophical seed. But when did someone actually try to, you know, draw the blueprints for a thinking machine?
That takes us to the 19th century. Charles Babbage, his designs for the difference engine and especially the analytical engine, those were the first real mechanical computers.
But the real insight there came from his collaborator, Ada Lovelace.
Oh, absolutely. She had this incredible moment of clarity. She realized Babbage's machine could work with any kind of symbol, not just numbers.
So text, music.
Anything. She basically conceptualized the first general purpose computer, a machine that could run algorithms on anything you could represent with a symbol.
And that idea just sits there for a while until Alan Turing picks it up in the 20th century.
He really does. His 1950 paper makes this huge leap. He argues the brain is an information processing machine, and that process can be replicated on a digital computer.
Which leads to his famous test, the imitation game, the Turing test.
It does. But there's this little gem right at the end of that paper that is so prescient.
What's that?
He basically says, look, trying to program an entire adult intelligence from scratch is, it's just too hard.
So don't.
Exactly. Instead, design a program that could learn like a child, learn from experience. And that single idea right there is the foundation of all modern machine learning.
That is the big pivot. Because for decades, the main approach was what they call GOFAI, good old-fashioned AI.
Right, the symbolic approach, where you try to write down every single rule for intelligence by hand.
And it worked for some things, like checkers or logic proofs.
For very structured problems, yeah. But it ran smack into a wall, a really famous wall called Moravec's paradox.
Ah, I love this paradox. It's so counterintuitive. It says the stuff that's hard for us, like advanced math, is easy for computers.
And the stuff that's easy for us.
Like recognizing a cat or picking up a cup is almost impossible for them to do. It's completely backwards. Why?
Two big reasons. First, we don't consciously know how we do the easy stuff. I mean, you can't write down the rules for how your visual cortex works.
You just do it.
You just do it. Second, the real world is messy. It's noisy. It's unpredictable. An object never looks exactly the same way twice. GOFAI just couldn't handle that kind of uncertainty.
So the answer was machine learning. If you can't write the rules, let the machine figure them out from data.
Exactly. Instead of rules, you just give it thousands of examples. You show it 1,000 pictures of cats and 1,000 pictures of dogs, and it learns the patterns itself.
And a simple way to see that is with something like a decision tree.
Right. The system might learn a rule like, does it bark? If yes, it's probably a dog. Does it hunt mice? If yes, probably a cat. It builds that logic itself from the examples.
But the most important approach, the one that really defines modern AI, is the artificial neural network.
Inspired by the brain, the first models came out in the 1940s, which led to the perceptron in 1957.
The perceptron was a kind of digital neuron.
A very simple one, yeah. It took in some inputs, added them up, and if they crossed a threshold, it fired. Oh. Simple. But it had one huge flaw.
The flaw that Minsky and Papert wrote a whole book about in 1969.
They did, and it was devastating. The problem was a single perceptron could only solve problems that were linearly separable.
Meaning you could draw a single straight line to separate the data. Cats on one side, dogs on the other.
Exactly. Anything more complex than that, and it was useless. And that book, Perceptrons, basically killed neural net research for decades. It just went into a deep freeze.
So after Minsky and Paper just hammered them,
yeah,
what was the technical breakthrough that finally brought neural networks back from the dead?
It was combining multi-layer networks with a training technique that used error backpropagation and gradient descent.
Okay, that's a mouthful. Let's break that down.
So the first step was to change the neuron model. Instead of a simple on-off switch, you give it a smooth, continuous output.
And why is that continuous function so important?
Because it lets you measure things. It allows the system to calculate the sensitivity of the error for every single connection in the network. We call that the gradient.
Okay, so a gradient is like a slope.
It's exactly like a slope. Imagine you're on a foggy mountain and you need to get to the bottom. You can't see, but you can feel the slope right under your feet. That's the gradient.
So you just always take a step in the steepest downhill direction.
That's it. You just keep taking small steps downhill. That process is called gradient descent. You do that millions of times with all your data, and the network slowly tunes itself to find the lowest possible error. It learns.
And that engine, that combination of backpropagation and gradient descent, could then train much deeper, multi-layered networks.
And that was the key. That's what let them solve those complex, nonlinear problems.
So now we have the engine. Where did they point it first? Vision, right?
Right back to biology. Hubel and Weisel won a Nobel Prize for their work on how cats see. They found specific neurons in the visual cortex that fire for, say, a horizontal line no matter where it is in the field of view.
It's called translation invariance.
Exactly. And that biological idea led directly to the convolutional neural network, the CNN. They've been around in some form since the 80s.
And they work by having these little feature detectors that scan across the whole image.
Yep, the same detector looks for an eye in the top left, the bottom right, everywhere.
But the real big bang moment for deep learning was in 2012. AlexNet.
GalaxNet, that's when everything changed. They unleashed a huge CNN on the ImageNet database, 14 million images, thousands of categories, and it crushed everything.
Why was that the moment? What did AlexNet do differently?
Two huge things. First, it was deep. 8 layers. That's where the name deep learning comes from. Deeper layers can learn more abstract concepts.
Mm-hmm.
A first layer sees edges. Later layers combine those into eyes, wheels, faces.
And the second thing?
The second thing was the hardware. They realized that GPUs, the graphics cards built for video games, were perfectly designed for the kind of math these networks need to do.
So it was this perfect convergence.
Yeah.
The algorithm, the massive data set, and finally, the right hardware to run it all.
A perfect storm. And the results. I mean, they speak for themselves. Today's best networks can classify ImageNet with about 3.7% error.
And humans.
Humans get about 5.1%. So in that specific task, the machines are now officially better than we are.
Which brings us to language. This is another area where for decades it seemed impossible.
For a long time, yeah. Early attempts like Eliza, the chatbot from the 60s, were just clever tricks. The real problem was scale.
Right. The problem you mentioned before, if English has 100,000 words, just trying to store the probabilities for what word comes next,
yeah,
it's just not possible.
You'd need thousands of terabytes of storage. It was a dead end. We needed a more efficient way to represent meaning.
And that efficient way turned out to be the transformer architecture from 2017.
That was the breakthrough. And the core idea inside the transformer is something called an embedding.
So instead of a word being a label in a dictionary, it becomes a point in space.
Exactly. A point in a high dimensional space, maybe in 1024 dimensions. And the genius is that the location of the point has meaning. Dog and puppy will be very close together. King and queen will have a similar relationship to man and woman.
The geometry of the space learns the semantics of the language. That's amazing.
It is. But the real engine inside the transformer is the self-attention mechanism.
Okay, what does that do?
It's like a spotlight. When you read a sentence, your brain automatically knows which other words are important to understand the word you're on right now. Self-attention lets the model do that.
So if it sees the word it, it can look back and figure out if it refers to the ball or the house from earlier in the sentence.
Precisely. It lets the model build a rich understanding of context, even over long distances. And that's what models like GPT are. They were just giant transformers.
And they're trained to be autoregressive.
Meaning they do one simple thing over and over. They predict the single most likely next word. Then they add that word to the input and do it again.
One word at a time. But the real turning point for usability was Instruct GPT in 2022.
a huge turning point, because before that, the models were just good at generating plausible text. InstructGPT was fine-tuned with human feedback to actually follow instructions.
So you could tell, summarize this, and it would actually do it.
Right. It aligned the model with user intent. That made it a useful tool, not just a cool toy. But this whole statistical process has a well-known side effect.
Hallucination.
And it's so important for you to understand this. They are not databases. They are plausibility engines. They generate what sounds right based on their training data.
Even if what sounds right is completely wrong.
Exactly. It might invent a legal case or a scientific study that sounds perfectly real but doesn't exist. You still have to verify everything.
Okay, let's shift to images. Generating images. This relies on a similar idea of connecting text and visuals. The CLIP system from 2021 was key here.
CLIP is the bridge. It learns a shared space, a shared map, where an image of a cat and the text, a photo of a cat, are located in the same spot. It aligns vision and language.
And that alignment is what powers these incredible diffusion models,
mm-hmm.
like DALL-E. The process here is, it's pretty wild. You start with just static.
Start with pure noise. And the model has been trained on one task, how to remove a little bit of noise to make a noisy image slightly cleaner.
So to make a new image, you just run that process in reverse.
Not quite. You run it forward. You start with 100% noise and you tell the model, take one small step away from noise in the direction of an astronaut riding a horse.
And it uses that CLIP map to know what direction that is.
Exactly. At every step, it removes a little noise, but it's guided by the text prompt. It nudges the static over hundreds of steps until it slowly resolves into the image you asked for.
We're seeing this move into video now with Sora and Veo, but the big challenge there is coherence, right? Making sure things stay consistent from one frame to the next.
Temporal coherence is the huge hurdle, but this all leads to the next big question. Where is this all going?
And the sources point to an idea from psychology. Dual process theory. System one and system two thinking.
From Daniel Kahneman, right. System one is our fast, intuitive gut reaction thinking. System two is our slow, deliberate, logical reasoning.
So deep learning, with its pattern matching, is like a super powerful system one.
And the old symbolic AI, GOFAI, is like a logical system too. The future seems to be in hybrid systems that can do both.
And we're already seeing this with techniques like retrieval augmented generation or RAG.
RAG is a great example. You have the LLM, the system one, but before it answers your question, it goes and queries a reliable database, the system two, to get verified facts.
So it reduces hallucination.
Massively.
RAG.
And it's making these tools useful for really critical fields like medicine and law.
But with all this promise, we have to talk about the risks, the immediate ones.
The erosion of privacy is a huge one. Every click, every search, every location ping, it's all used to build these incredibly detailed predictive models about you.
And then there's disinformation.
Maybe the scariest short-term threat, the ability to create convincing fake audio, fake video deepfakes, means you just can't trust what you see and hear anymore.
There was that case in the Slovakia election in 2023.
A perfect example. A fake audio clip of a politician surfaces just 2 days before the vote. It spreads like wildfire. It's impossible to know how much it affected the outcome, but it's a terrifying new weapon in politics.
Which brings us to the biggest, most existential risk of all, agency.
The idea that a future AI could develop its own goals that might not be aligned with ours.
And this is where the AI community is really split, isn't it?
It's a profound split. You have the AI boomers, the accelerationists like Jan LeCun, who basically say this is science fiction, that intelligence will always be a tool tied to a specific task.
And on the other side,
you have the AI doomers. People like Geoffrey Hinton, one of the godfathers of the field, who are extremely worried and are calling for us to slow down. They see a real risk of losing control.
And trying to regulate this. I mean, the technology is moving so much faster than the legislation.
It's a massive challenge. Laws like the EU AI Act are already struggling to keep up. And there's a risk they could stifle innovation if they're too heavy-handed.
So after all that, what does this mean for you, the listener? I think history shows us we are terrible at predicting the long-term impact of technologies this big.
We really are. What we can say is that AI will amplify and transform human intelligence. And looking way out, you can see maybe three paths for intelligence on this planet.
What are they?
Well, one is that we have two competing intelligence species. Mm-hmm. Another is that artificial intelligence just takes over. Or the third, and maybe the most hopeful, is that we achieve a kind of symbiotic hybrid intelligence.
Or a partnership.
A true partnership.
And speaking of far futures, here's a final thought to leave you with. Human biology is just not built for interstellar travel. the distances, the radiation, the time. But digital intelligence has none of those limits. So it's possible that the way humanity finally reaches the stars won't be in metal ships, but is digital consciousness, carried by these very systems. Our AI descendants could become our ambassadors to the cosmos. Something to think about the next time you look up at the sky.